This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallahi wallahu ghafurur rahim. يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
3 headlines. Israeli warplanes target areas near 3 hospitals in the Gaza Strip after the regime orders 20 hospitals in the besieged territory to evacuate. Iran's President Raisi strongly condemns U.S. President's pro-Israeli remarks as reactionary and inhumane, saying that they prove the regime's fake nature. And people around the world take to the streets to condemn Israeli atrocities against the people of Palestine. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Leave or face death. This is yet another warning the Israeli military has issued to residents living in the northern part of the besieged Gaza Strip. The warning comes as hundreds of thousands of Gazans have already moved southward to take refuge in temporary shelters. However, the areas that they have fled to are also being hit by Israeli warplanes and artillery. More than 4,700 Palestinians have been killed since the regime launched its onslaught on Gaza over 2 weeks ago. More than 16,000 people have been wounded. According to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, it has also lost at least 29 of its staff in Israeli bombardments. In the meantime, the Israeli military said one of its tanks had accidentally fired at an Egyptian post near the border with Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli warplanes have rained down bombs in areas around 3 hospitals in Gaza, adding to the immense strain on medical facilities in the besieged territory. According to Palestinian media reports, Israeli missiles hit the vicinity of Al-Shifa and Al-Quds hospitals in Gaza City. The strike also hurt near Indonesia Hospital in northern Gaza, and its director reported injuries and severe damage to the complex. But there were no immediate reports of possible destruction and injuries near the 2 other hospitals. On Saturday, Israel ordered 20 hospitals in Gaza, including Al-Quds, to evacuate. The regime is facing a chorus of condemnation from around the world over its bombardment of Al-Ahli Hospital on Tuesday. Nearly 500 people, including those who had taken refuge from Israel's assaults, were killed in the strike. Kuryaria Goda is with the Federation of the Iraqi Trade Unions. She tells us about the need for solidarity with Palestinians amid Israel's onslaught on Gaza and the normalization deals between some Arab states and the regime.
Right now, the people of Gaza and the children of Gaza are dying, and the world is quiet. Even some of the Arab countries that pretend to be concerned for the future of Jerusalem and its liberation, they are now normalizing with Israel. This thing, the normalization, which is humiliating and frightening because the people of Palestine is in need of total solidarity and support, and a firm stand of every Arab and all free people of the world. We are embroiled with them in the struggle, even though we are from far-off lands geographically. We continue our struggle with them in order to prepare and mobilize the Arab public opinion and international public opinion in order to assist and support and stand firmly with the struggle of the Palestinian people. And now I believe that the Iraqi people will spare nothing, will not hold back to be with their Palestinian people in solidarity. And in fact, some youth have all the determination to go to Palestine in order to help their people in Gaza.
Israel is also escalating its atrocities in the West Bank while continuing its relentless bombardment of the Gaza Strip. The regime forces have killed 2 more Palestinians in the occupied territory. 17-year-old Jihad Saleh and Muhammad Abu Zer, aged 29, were fatally shot during an Israeli raid on the town of Zawata, west of Nablus. 2 other Palestinians were injured by the regime's live bullets. Earlier, another young Palestinian was killed by Israeli troops near a refugee camp north of Al-Khalil. Since the start of Israel's bloody war in Gaza, 93 Palestinians have been killed and some 1,400 others injured in the West Bank. Israel says one of its troops was killed and 3 others injured during a raid into the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military spokesman says the raid was carried out as part of a preparation for a ground attack and to gather intelligence. Earlier, the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said that it had ambushed an Israeli armored unit that had trespassed a few meters into the territory. The Al-Qassam brigades added that 2 Israeli bulldozers and a tank were destroyed, and the forces retreated back across the separation fence. Hamas has warned that Gaza will turn into a graveyard for the invaders. The resistance movement has also been firing thousands of missiles into Israel. Since the beginning of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, at least 1,500 Israelis have been killed and nearly 5,000 injured. Mira Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more about the ongoings in the occupied territories. Mona, I believe we're seeing an uptick in terms of the number of Palestinians that are being killed, unless I'm mistaken there. Tell us what has occurred in the past 24 hours.
This morning, the number of Palestinian martyrs by the Israeli forces had even risen to 95. Israeli troops raided Al-Jalazon refugee camp early on Monday, and clashes erupted between the Israeli forces and Palestinians. The Israeli troops killed two more Palestinians, Mahmoud Saif Nakhle and Mohammed Nidal Alayan. Both are from the Al-Jalazon refugee camp. Four others had been wounded, and at least 17 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli forces in the refugee camp of Al-Jalazon. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, over 75 Palestinians had been killed, had been arrested by the Israeli forces only on Monday in several areas in the Al-Jalazon refugee camp, in Beit Lahem, in Al-Khalil, and in Jenin as well. Those Palestinian prisoners who had been detained by the Israeli forces, the Palestinian prisoners' institutions say that the majority are Palestinian are civilians. Others are Palestinian activists who express their rejection, who call for the end of the Israeli massacres being carried out on this being carried out in the Gaza Strip. Of course, they are posting on their pages on social media. Others were taking part in the anti-Israeli protests and demonstrations that had been taking place since the first day, the 7th of October, when the Al-Aqsa flood operation started and the Israeli war being carried out on the Gaza Strip. Yesterday, as alone, in 24 hours, eight Palestinians had been killed in several areas in separate incidents in Al-Khalil, in Ariha, in Askar refugee camp Zawata near Nablus, as well as in the Jenin refugee camp when the Israeli airstrike targeted a mosque inside the refugee camp of Jenin. As you also mentioned, the Israeli military declared that at least one Israeli soldier had been killed. Three others had been wounded by anti-tank missile fired from Gaza. The missile fired toward the tank, this operation near the Gaza border, according to the Israeli military.
Are we looking at still the state of affairs when it comes to the occupied territories as a whole, where you have people and businesses and not much activity going on in that respect?
Movement between areas is almost impossible here in the occupied West Bank, where the areas where the roads leading to northern the occupied West Bank are completely closed with numerous military checkpoints. The main one is the Hawara military checkpoint that allows the entry to the cities of Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarem, Qalqilia had been closed. And even the village of Hawara that is adjacent to the military checkpoint of Hawara, the shops had been ordered to continue be closing, no schools there, no businesses, and the Israelis had sent even more soldiers to deploy not only at the military checkpoint, but also jeeps are seen in the narrow roads after the Hawara military checkpoint. In Al-Khalil, for instance, yesterday a Palestinian was killed while he was trying to leave his village in one of the Palestinian villages in Al-Khalil. Immediately, Israeli soldiers were stationing inside one of the military towers He was 400 meters away from them. However, the Israelis had been ordering that no one is allowed to leave the villages there in Al-Khalil. He was, according to our sources there, he was trying to reach his sick father. His father had a heart attack, and he wanted to visit his father in the hospital immediately. Because of this curfew, he was driving his vehicle, and Israeli forces opened fire at him and killed him. So yes, there's no official declaration that there is a closure on the occupied West Bank. However, several areas are completely closed. Several areas, Palestinians are not allowed to leave or to enter these villages. The routes between northern the occupied West Bank, the center, and southern the occupied West Bank are cut with the numerous checkpoints, and with Israeli forces are using their guns to shoot and kill people in cold blood.
Okay, thank you for that. Now let's bring in Brian Dawson, who's a human rights activist, joining us from Seoul. Brian Dawson, welcome. I guess I'm going to start out with a simple question, when you take a look at the 15 days to have now transpired ever since the war broke out from October 7th, we're still seeing Israel bomb the Gaza Strip, and we're still seeing the death toll mount on the Palestinian side. Isn't there something wrong with this picture where Israel is allowed to continue doing what it's doing?
Obviously, and the pictures are out, the videos are out. They're bombing apartments full of people. They bombed mosques, they bombed churches, they bombed hospitals, they bombed infrastructure. They even bombed a caravan after sending leaflets to say, hey, move south this direction, and then they bombed that too. But there's no real international pressure. There was a UN resolution that got vetoed by the US. Then the US made its own resolution, which was horrifying. They drafted it, it hasn't been passed, but they drafted a resolution saying, yeah, Iran cannot supply Hezbollah with weapons, but of course the U.S. can supply the Israelis with weapons, and they did. They gave them thermobaric bunker buster bombs, which were used on civilians. They've bombed this city more than Dresden. They've dropped more bombs on the Gaza Strip than the U.S. did to Afghanistan over a 20-year period, and this is a 2-by-25-mile area. Most of the world is sick of it, sick of seeing it. They are decrying Israel as committing war crimes. Israel's also, in addition to that, used chemical weapons like white phosphorus. But there isn't much they can do about it. As long as the United States stands with Israel and puts its carriers in the Mediterranean, everyone's afraid to act. Look how long it took Egypt to get aid across the border. It ended up only being like 17 trucks. And then Israel bombed Rafah anyway.
Yeah, so trying to understand, trying to understand a lot of things over here, but the way that Israel is continuing with this carnage, it has accomplices, and this is a scenario that the U.S. is unfortunately used to, but the biggest accomplice to this is the U.S. What do you think is the communication between the two when Israel is continuing with this carnage? Does that mean the U.S. has given it the green light for it to go ahead, and additionally wants it to continue, but on a wider scale, if it goes into, for example, into the Gaza Strip?
It looks like that. You would think that this is an insane act, but in addition to giving Israel more weapons for their air force, the U.S. decided to create an aid package, and Joe Biden got out and gave a speech how they're going to lump it all together with Ukraine and Israel, and maybe even something for the U.S.'s own border. But the majority of that's going overseas, as if Israel needs tens of billions or even $100 billion. That was the reaction of the U.S. after watching all these people get massacred, is to give the side doing the massacre more aid and more weapons.
All right. The governments around the world, not many, but some, even within the U.S., actually, we're seeing some lawmakers or people who are in a higher capacity within the government, for example, like lawmakers in the U.S., that have shown their compassion for the Palestinians. They have realized that they need to speak up, and that is causing divisions. That's accompanied, of course, with the mass protests that we're seeing out there on the streets, that Some are saying the genie is really out of the bottle now, and there's no way it can turn back. How do you see turning out in terms of people in governments around the world, some of them anyways, speaking up for Palestinians?
Yeah, Joshua Paul resigned from the State Department because of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and pointed out correctly, how is this going to make this better? The last five wars of going in and quote-unquote mowing the lawn didn't do it. How is this going to make it any better? It won't. So people are resigning from their positions. There are protests within the United States. In fact, they went into the Capitol building, a completely pro-Palestinian group, and took that. They're all in the streets of New York City. You can see them in Chicago. Unfortunately, too much emphasis is put on people yelling at buildings and waving flags. That isn't effective unless the media covers it and everyone else gets to see what's going on. And the media isn't covering it. That's the problem. It would be much more effective if all those people went in and lobbied and went directly to the people in power and make the rules and talked to them instead of chanting from the river to the sea and those kind of things. That is a lot of wasted energy that could be directed in a much, much more palpable model that would be much more effective. Doing the adult thing and going in the building. If you have representative government like the United States does, go talk to your governor, go talk to your state senators, go talk to the people in D.C., your congressmen, the people you elected, because they're the only ones that have the power to change this. Running around in the street with flags does show solidarity and it feels good emotionally, but it's not effective compared to lobbying.
And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willest, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Good. What does the name of Shiraz remind you of? Personally, hearing the name of Shiraz reminds me of the smell of orange flower at the beginning of spring. It's well-known poets Sa'di and Hafez. It's unique and beautiful gardens and architecture. I picture Pasargad and Persepolis. But never forget that this city is home to a gem which is unique in terms of architecture and design. Yes, I'm talking about the breathtaking Nasirul Mulk Mosque, or
the pink mask. Actually, an Iran must-do experience is witnessing the light path through the Nasirul Mulk mask. Fascinated? In my trip to Shiraz, I'm going to discuss this mask's notable features, history, and architecture in more detail. And I have planned to visit this mask early in the morning, since the magic will disappear in a few hours. Nasirul Mulk Mosque, or the Pink Mosque, is one of the magnificent historical monuments of the city of Shiraz in Fars province, southern Iran. This spectacular mosque, which dates back to the Qajarid era, is beautifully built in terms of architecture and tiling. Stained glasses are used in this mosque's design, and it is one of the masterpieces of Iranian architecture. As the sunlight passes through glasses and the combination of colors, the pink mask is eye-catching. The unique architecture of the pink mask includes spectacular tile works with natural and various colors being used for coloring them. Symmetrical tiling, which is seen in all parts of the Nasirul Mulk Mosque, is one of the most attractive forms of tile works and one of the architectural masterpieces in Iran. Carved stone columns, inspired by Vakil Mosque in Shiraz, are its other beauties. Furthermore, seven wooden doors with colorful windows, together with sunlight and the reflection of colors on the columns and the tiles, make the mosque significantly the eye-catching one. Well, what attracted me to this mosque when I was seeing its pictures was its architecture. Actually, its attractive Islamic architecture. Here I am close to the mosque. Wow! Look at it! Undoubtedly, this mosque is one of the most beautiful mosques in the world. And you know why it's called the Pink Mosque? Because in this mosque, the color pink is used much more than other mosques. And here I enter the northern courtyard of the mosque. Believe it or not, this site is really unique in terms of its architecture. And there is a shallow and wide pool in the middle of the courtyard, which is decorated with flowers and plants. Every corner of this mosque must be photographed. I am now exactly in front of the main facade of the mosque. A great arch with 7 colored tiles. Unique. It's called the Pearl Arch because of its recessed arches which look like pearls. And the roof is magnificently arched with Mugharnas design. Let me take some photos. Aha! Great. Two wooden doors lead us to the interior. Wait a minute. Aha! There is a marble stone which has a poem on it. The poem is by the Iranian poet Shuride Shirazi, which is about this mosque. Interesting. Well, I passed through a long corridor. By the way, this mosque has 2 shabistans. A shabistan of a mosque is a roofed space with identical and parallel columns. It leads to the central courtyard from one side. And I prefer to enter the eastern shabistan at first. Oh, you can witness the glory of simplicity in this part of the mosque. Wow, the walls and forehead of the arch is decorated with verses of the Noble Quran and floral tilings. Very attractive. You may not believe, but I feel really calm as I look at them. At the back of the eastern shabistan, a door opens to what is known to be the kawel, and it refers to the water pulled up from the well with the help of animals. During the summer, they would tie the cows to the wells, so they would pull water out of the wells. The water was used for drinking and watering purposes. Now I'm ready to visit the most spectacular part of the mosque. Yes, the western shabistan.
Thank you.
cut them. Wheat-colored stones are used in this part of the mosque. The decorations of this Shabistan are inspired by the Vakil Mosque of Shiraz. The walls of the Western Shabistan have been decorated with beautiful tilings, and the floor is covered with turquoise tiles and interior brick walls. The ceiling, yes, it is embellished with floral and arabesque patterns and verses of the Noble Quran. Thick, spiral-shaped stone columns are standing in two rows of six. The logic behind these 12 columns refers to the 12 infallible imams, peace upon them. The Western Shabistan has 8 wooden doors, beautifully decorated with colorful stained glasses, and they all open to the main courtyard. Nasirul Mulk Mosque owes its popularity to its colorful glasses. And here, I'd like to take tens of photos.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. In this special edition of Palestine Declassified, we're going to examine the extraordinary armed uprising of the Palestinian people against the Zionist entity, which has repeatedly and flagrantly spurned every single peaceful attempt to secure justice for Palestine. First up is Latifa Abu Chakra with a special report about this audacious military offensive by Palestinian freedom fighters that began in the early hours of Saturday morning on October the 7th.
As fragile as a spider's web, the Zionist entity is shaking with fear. In an early morning shock, Palestinian resistance factions from Gaza launched an unprecedented three-pronged attack on the entity. First, armed fighters sailed over the Israeli fence to Gaza using hand gliders. Simultaneously, 5,000 rockets were launched into the Zionist entity from the open-air prison of Gaza, disabling that much-vaunted Iron Dome system. At the same time, Palestinians broke down the fence, which fighters had sailed over, using bulldozers. What ensued was the homecoming of at least 1,000 Palestinians from the resistance factions into the fragile Zionist entity. Military bases were seized by the resistance, and Israel's Merkava tanks were captured and taken back to Gaza. Settlements like Sderot, whose Zionist guests had previously watched from hilltops while Gaza was bombed, were seized by the resistance. Over 100 settlers have been taken as prisoners of war by the resistance. The vast majority are members of the occupation forces. An area of occupied Palestine larger than the Gaza Strip was taken and held by the resistance factions, who reached within only 10 kilometers of the West Bank city of Al-Khalil, known to settlers as Hebron. It is documented that resistance factions were able to fashion weapons from unexploded munitions dropped on them by the Israelis. But did weapons from NATO escapades in Afghanistan and Ukraine really end up in Gaza? Time will tell. The fear of South Lebanon is palpable among the settlers, so much so that an Israeli occupation unit opened fire on an approaching truck close to Lebanon. They discovered that the vehicle carried 7 Israeli fighters. All had been killed by the Zionist friendly fire. Overall, in a space of 48 hours, at least 700 settlers were killed. The vast majority were part of the occupation forces. To put the figure into perspective, in proportion to the size of the population of the colony, that is the equivalent of over 20,000 people in the United States. In the midst of it all, Russian hacker group Killnet took down the site of the Israeli regime administration, further spreading panic and fear. Nearly all major stocks in Israel are in the red, with the benchmark index recording the biggest loss for over a year. Poland and Bulgaria have sent military planes to evacuate their citizens and bring them back home to Europe.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Sami Al-Aryan, who is a public affairs professor and a long-standing political activist whose roots are in Palestine. And Sami has vigorously campaigned for Palestinian liberation for many years, and he was blacklisted in the United States because of his political views. And he joins us today via Skype from Istanbul. Welcome to the show. Sami, perhaps we could start with you. Are we witnessing the death spasms of the Zionist idea, do you think?
Well, we have to go back to the origins of Zionism. Zionism was the political movement of Jewish elites at the end of the 19th century, and it was their response to Europe's anti-Semitism that existed at the time, particularly in Russia, the pogroms, and continued to what the experts would call the Jewish question. And they tried to answer that by basically creating an exclusivist, settler, colonial, racist state that has been trying for over a century to uproot the native people of Palestine from their native land and try to replace them with Jews around the world. This is what Zionism is about, and I think it has failed, but it continues to be strong in terms of the state because of the support it has been receiving from mainly Western governments, particularly the United States. But I think now it's becoming very clear that that kind of response would not be accepted in the 21st century, particularly with the steadfastness of the Palestinians and the resistance to this racist, exclusivist movement and entity.
No, indeed. I mean, David, do you think Israel was caught completely unawares by this operation?
It does seem so. I mean, there's been some reporting, hasn't there, that the Egyptian intelligence services said something was going to happen, but they were ignored. So, I mean, I've seen the various other theories, let's not title them conspiracy theories, that have said that this is a false flag, that the Zionists let it happen, let all these hundreds of people be killed, or they thought that maybe a lesser number would be killed. But no, it's clear that that's not what's happened. What's happened clearly has been an operation planned for many, many months in Gaza and with the other resistance factions across the territories. And it's taken them entirely by surprise, but also, more importantly, it has inflicted an extremely significant military, intelligence, and psychological defeat on the Zionists. Indeed. They didn't think that this could ever happen to them. Mm. And the fact that they've had to evacuate people, thousands and thousands of people, from all of the settlements around Gaza, and indeed they're talking about evacuating all the settlements near the northern border should Hezbollah enter the conflict much more significantly than they have so far. So we're seeing a defeat for Zionism and a crisis for them, really, because they're facing a real difficulty now of the possibility of the end of the Zionist entity.
Indeed, and people queuing up at the airport, weren't they, to actually
to
leave Israel.
To be evacuated, yes. So
there's indeed some prominent figures, actually, in the Zionist entity, as well, as I understand it. But, David, I wonder if you could say a word or two as well about the conditions that people in Gaza have been living in over the years.
Well, people know the phrase, don't they? This is an open-air prison.
Indeed.
And of course, there's been an attempt by the Zionists in the last week or so, 10 days, to say, oh, no, it's not occupied. Look, we left Gaza in 2005. This is not an occupation. But, of course, it's entirely surrounded. It's surveilled 24 hours a day. And, you know, it underlines the scale of the achievement that the resistance could undermine all of that. But this is an open-air prison. And they've even, in the last few days, intensified the siege. No water, no electricity, nothing is going in or out. And they've even closed the Rafah crossing into Egypt, despite saying to people in Gaza, you must leave. The Rafah crossing is open. It's not anymore, and they're talking about bombing that as well.
Indeed.
So this is an open prison. It has been for many years. Most of the water in Gaza is not drinkable. There are shortages of everything, including medicines. There are food problems. It's been bombed so many times that there's so much rubble there that they've had to actually start to use the rubble in ingenious ways to build new buildings. So it's an appalling state. Yes. It's the worst place in the world under constant military supervision and, yes, occupation by the Israelis.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you say that obviously it's well known that it's an open-air prison, and yet, you know, the corporate media... If you actually read the corporate media or listen to the broadcast channels of the corporate media, they don't really talk about it in those terms, do they?
Well, thankfully, I don't depend on the corporate media for
my
reporting. Although, of course,
but a lot of people
many people
though.
Still do, yes, that's true. Although, of course, many, many more in the last 20 years have turned off from that. But yes,
true.
The corporate media presents a systematically distorted and skewed view and version of what's happening. Although, on the question of occupation, the Zionists have been complaining in the last little while about CBC, the Canadian broadcasters, saying that journalists should not use the word should use the word occupation because it still is an occupation. And so that's even the mainstream media won't go as far to what should we call it, to kind of fantasy land as the Zionists want them to.
No, indeed. But Sammy, I mean, in what way would you say is this war different from previous wars on Gaza?
It's quite different. I mean, if you look at the previous four or five wars starting from 2008, 2009, all of them were initiated by the Zionist state. This time it was different. It was surprising. It was the, you're describing as an open-air prison. It was basically a prison break where the Palestinians themselves took the initiative and attacked. And always you have that benefit of the surprise. And therefore, what happened, what ensued after that was huge success, huge victory for the resistance. They were able to actually dismantle this myth of the invincibility of the Israeli army, that this is not an invincible army, but in fact, it's an army that was caught flat-footed, and they were shown by few fighters. I mean, these fighters were basically not a regular army. These are mostly volunteers, Palestinian resistors, but they're determined, and they have the will to fight until they gain their freedom and independence and liberation. And we've seen in the first 60 hours how they were going, attacking the military bases, the settlers, the settlements. They were bringing back all kinds of prisoners of war in order to force the exchange and free their comrades in prisons.
Yeah. I mean, David, it said that I think it was 11 U.S. citizens were killed in the operation. I mean, what do you think explains, you know, so many foreign nationals being present in Palestine?
And there's been a British person being confirmed now as being killed over the weekend. Well, what explains this, of course, is something quite different to the explanation about civilians or American citizens or British citizens even being killed in Ukraine, because they are, everybody understands, they are mercenaries. But here, these people are either settlers or they're actually involved directly in being enrolled in what's called the Israel Defense Forces, the Israel occupation forces. The British guy, for example, 19 or 20 years old, was actually in the IDF.
Yes.
Now this is about British citizens as foreign fighters.
We
call these people foreign fighters if they were in Syria or somewhere else, but we don't call them foreign fighters in this case. And of course, when those people who regularly go from Britain or from the US to join the oppressive forces of Israel come back, they're not interrogated as being terrorists. They're not interrogated and asked for why they've got involved in armed violence and killing of civilians. And actually, you know, in the structural violations of international law, which Israel day by day is committing. So there's a real question here about how we actually change the way in which our society works so that people from the UK are not allowed to go to fight for Israel.
No, indeed. I mean, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, was saying, you know, our thoughts are with the British citizen who was killed. But surely the question should be, why are British citizens serving in the Israeli occupation forces? But we'll just pause there for a moment because we've got another report now looking at the strategic implications for the United States and Israel as a result of the military operation by the Palestinian resistant factions.
As the Palestinian resistance factions prepared for their operation early on Saturday morning, they must have known they were about to embark on what will surely be seen as the most historic mission of any Palestinian resistance fighters. They broke out of the open-air prison of Gaza for the first time since Gaza was occupied in 1967. Of course, the Zionist regime has answered the challenge with a bloody onslaught on civilians, killing more than 100 children in little over a day. They deliberately and openly targeted civilian infrastructure in a frenzy of revenge that hides the strategic vacuum. They've diverted personnel from the West Bank and have laid siege to Gaza. Nothing can go in or out. But the chess game can easily end in an existential threat. Never has the idea that Israel is a temporary entity been so palpable. The United States has issued bellicose warnings and says it is moving forces closer to the entity, but this has drawn fiery riposte from the resistance axis, from Hezbollah, and from the Iraqi resistance, making it plain that escalation means that U.S. personnel will be legitimate targets across the whole region. President Joe Biden gave a nod to the difficulties faced by the much-vaunted U.S. hegemon when he warned supporters of the Palestinians not to take advantage of the circumstances. He didn't say it, but the circumstances are a decline of U.S. power, a notable shortage of U.S. weaponry, which has been effectively destroyed in Ukraine. A little-known U.S. stockpile of ammunition held in Israel has been depleted by supplies in Ukraine. Current Pentagon plans to increase production will not even keep pace with the 6,000 shells expended each day by the Ukrainians. The entry of Hezbollah into conflict from the north is an indication of the strategic vice that Israel finds itself in. By Monday, Zionist radar station was decommissioned and the border fence at the northern border with Lebanon was blown up. Any ground war in Gaza will face stiff resistance, and there will be many more occupation force casualties. Does the entity have the appetite for this? And will it mean the foundations of Zionism begin to crumble? Since the beginning, the security of the Zionist entity has depended on having enough Jewish citizens to win the demographic struggles against the Palestinians. With so many settlers fleeing from the airports and settlers from Poland and Bulgaria being evacuated, how long before the entity crumbles and the dismantling of Zionism begins in earnest? If the special military operation in Ukraine was the first act of the age of multipolarity, the prison bust from Gaza is the opening of the second act. The future is unwritten.
Sammy, your family was expelled from Palestine in 1948, wasn't it? I mean, can you tell us about how you responded to the Gaza breakout over the weekend?
I mean, generations of Palestinians had their hope, the hope of the return to their ancestors' lands. My grandfather and my father, who both passed away years ago, had that hope. It was not fulfilled. I have that hope, which I hope that it would be fulfilled during my lifetime. But if not, certainly my children would have that hope. What we witnessed this weekend was that this is possible, that this myth that the Palestinians would forget over generations, that old would die and the new would forget, is just a myth, is not true. The fact of the matter is that millions of Palestinians outside Palestine, inside Palestine, yearn to the time where we would enter Palestine and be in that land again. You know, this notion of two state, one state solutions, where it will basically exclude millions of Palestinians from going back, is not going to succeed. I think our goal, our objective should be the dismantlement of the Zionist state because of its racist, exclusivist, colonial structure, that this is an apartheid system that cannot survive the change in this world. And therefore, when this crumbles, and we have seen a glimpse of how could that be, when that happens, then we could truly then talk about peace and talk about harmony and solve, by the way, the Jewish problem, because Zionism redefined Judaism, and I think we need to save Judaism from the evil and from the ideology of Zionism.
The Indeed. David, I mean, would you say that this was an explosion of anger from Gaza in response to the endless provocations from the Zionist entity, or do you think there's something more strategic going on here?
Well, it would be no surprise to say that people in Gaza are a little bit angry
indeed
with the Zionists. But this is not some spasm, some emotional outburst. This has been planned for a long, long time, at least a year, it seems, that Hamas and the other resistance factions, who we don't talk about enough, people talk about this being Hamas
indeed
doing this or Hamas doing that.
But
it's Hamas,
yes.
It's the Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
Yes.
It's the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Indeed.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine were involved. And indeed, even armed groups, the armed wing of Fatah, have been involved in some of these actions, not to mention the various factions across the West Bank. So this is a thing which has been in planning for at least a year and is a strategic activity. It's not as if this is over. There are other sorts of things which are going to fall into place. We've seen already from the north Hezbollah and to some extent other factions like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon making a breach of the fence at the border. This is a strategic thing, and there are all sorts of structural questions in this chess game about who next comes into the frame. And that's what we have to see. That's what the future tells us here. This is not going to be something where the Zionists can just crush the resistance, because there are all sorts of consequences for their actions.
Yes, indeed. Of course, the focus just being on Hamas by the corporate media is another example, I suppose, of the misreporting by the mainstream press and broadcast media. But Sammy, what do you think the strategy of the resistance factions is?
Well, I don't think there is any illusion among the resistance fighters that this was a war of liberation. I think they had several objectives in mind, five in particular. The first one would be to stop this daily encroachment, incursion, desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the holy places that have been taking place throughout the year, particularly in the last 3 weeks. Secondly, it was an attempt also to stop the incursion and the daily attacks on Palestinian youth in different West Bank cities, killing them, imprisoning them, detaining them, kidnapping them, which has also claimed over 240 lives this year in the West Bank alone. 40 of them are children. Third, it was an attempt also to, because Israel has been refusing to exchange its prisoners for the few prisoners in Gaza, so there was an attempt to basically get more prisoners of war to force Israel to make that, since 5,500 Palestinians, including many women and children, in prison, and their lives have been even made much worse when Ben-Gvir became the person in charge of the prison system. And fourth, it is to lift the siege on the 16-year blockade and siege against Gaza. Over 2 million people have been under siege now without the word really caring or given much attention to this tragedy, to this genocidal policy. And fifth and last, which is very important, is to show the world that the Palestinians are determined and resolved to continue fighting and resisting the occupation, including fighting, but also including to show the world that they are capable of defeating an enemy on the ground. And I call also that our fight is not just militarily, that we need to engage the Zionist groups and Zionist ideology and Zionist supporters and governments, those who support it, on all fields, politically, economically, commercially, legally, human rights, artistically, media-wise, in all spheres, in all geographies.
Yes, indeed. But David, I mean, what do you make of the response of the remainder of the resistance axis? Do you think that will deter the Zionists?
Well, people need to understand that the resistance axis is an actual thing, that the resistance in Lebanon, the Hezbollah, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, the Ansarawa in Yemen, and of course the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is an actual functioning set of organizations who work together. They don't plan each other's activities, but they are coordinating with each other. And that's the key to this, is that if there is an escalation from the Americans, the resistance in Hezbollah, in Iraq, have said that they will regard US targets across the region as legitimate. Now, that is a big question. What does that mean in terms of wider conflagration? It's also a question about what happens if there is a ground invasion of Gaza. If there's a ground invasion, the IDF, the Israeli occupation forces, will take very, very heavy casualties. And it will also mean a massive escalation. Hezbollah will almost certainly come in from the north. And that, of course, is something which will be concentrating the minds of Netanyahu and his cabinet about how far they can go to pursue their goals of eliminating